It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, gas prices are on the rise, even though crude oil prices continue to fall. We'll figure out what's making the difference.
But first, we look at a Maryland case that's getting a lot of attention. This week, two parents were found responsible for unsubstantiated child neglect for letting their two kids take a walk together about a mile from their home. The kids were 6 and 10 years old.
The parents were practicing the philosophy of free-range parenting, a parenting movement started by our next guest.
The free-range philosophy holds that kids learn self-reliance by making some of their own choices and progressively exploring the world on their own, bit by bit. And we want to hear from you on this. Do you think kids should be allowed to go on long walks by themselves, to be a little bit free-range, as our guest calls it? Are we too protective of our kids' safety, or are we not protective enough? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take your calls in just a bit, but first, Lenore Scanese joins us. She's a blogger, host of the TLC show World's Worst Mom, and author of the book Free Range Kids. Lenore, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to be here, Rob. Thanks.
So what do you make of this decision, holding the parents responsible for what they're calling unsubstantiated child neglect?
I mean, could you come up with a more Kafkaesque phrase? I mean, it's like, you're responsible for something that we didn't substantiate. Okay, good. What are you trying to say? But the thing that was disturbing to Danielle and to me is that it seems that by calling them, quote-unquote, responsible for anything, it allows CPS, Child Protective Services, to keep their case open for another 5 years, which is terrible because they are free-range parents. Free-range parents believe in letting our kids have some unsupervised time outside, that shouldn't be a crime, and having this sword of Damocles hanging over their heads is awful.
Does this worry you? Do you think this sends a message to people who are doing the free-range kids approach and might make them think twice?
Yes, I'm very worried that people who used to write to me who were afraid that their kids were going to be snatched by a predator are now afraid that their kids will be snatched by the police. And so there's a couple things I'm doing, and I hope people will join me in them, to make sure that we are allowed to let our kids play outside the way we did, especially considering the crime rate today is back to what it was in 1963. First of all, I'm trying to get a Bill of Rights in front of either local communities or Congress that says it is a child's right to have some unsupervised time inside the house and especially outside the house, and it is a parent's right to give that to them when the parents feel it's appropriate. So that's just a basic right that we don't have now. So I want to pass the Bill of Rights, and you can find it on my site, freerangekids.com. Just look up Bill of Rights, and there it is. And the other thing I'm doing, because so many times, like even for me, when I wanted to send my kids outside to play or to walk someplace, they'd go out and they'd come right back in because there were no other kids outside anymore. And so that was driving me crazy. It's driving a lot of other free-range parents crazy, and I think there's strength in numbers as well as safety. And so I started a thing called freerangefriend.com, where you can go in. It's this free little widget I had somebody develop, where you put in your zip code and the years that your kids were born, and then you can find other parents who also want to send their kids outside. So if my kids have Saturday morning free and so do yours, we say, okay, let's send them to the park. Great. Now they have somebody to play with. And then it starts looking normal again. You don't have busybodies dialing 911 to say, I saw a child in the park, because there's 10 children in the park. Then there's 20 children in the park. And then we renormalize kids being outside. So my whole mission now is to remind parents that even if it seems scary and like CPS is going to swoop in, the way to fight back is not to lock our kids inside and say, okay, you win. It's to have so many kids outside that CPS is either overwhelmed with phone calls or nobody dials 911 anymore when they see a kid outside because there are hordes of them.
Now, this decision has gotten a lot of attention. What do you think it says about how safe we as a culture think the world is for our kids?
Well, what I love about the attention that this decision has brought is that it seems to have shifted the public conversation in a direction I feel is very great, which is from, oh, my God, there's a child outside, that's dangerous, to, oh, my God, these kids were just walking home and they're arresting the parents. How dare the government? I mean, I'm a liberal-turned-libertarian. I blog for a place called Reason now, which is a libertarian site, because it started occurring to me that I don't want the government telling me that I can't send my kids outside if I think it's safe. I'm a rational parent. I know that the odds are never going to be absolutely perfect that my kids are going to be safe outside, but the odds are never perfect in any activity, even driving them is not a perfect activity. So why isn't it up to me to decide how I want to raise my kids? And if I want to give them fresh air and exercise and the confidence that comes from being the kid who knows how to get to school and can cross the street, that's up to me, not up to the state.
Lenora, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rob. I know I netter on, but I just want to see so many kids outside. Wisconsin, gosh, I grew up in Wilmette, Illinois, and we had the most wonderful times in Kenosha every year in Petrified Springs. So I want kids to have what I had.
That was Lenore Scanese. She's a blogger, host of the TLC show World's Worst Mom, and author of the book Free Range Kids.
And we'd love to hear what you think. Do you think kids should be allowed to be a bit free range to explore on their own sometimes? Are we too protective of our kids' safety, or are we not protective enough? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll get to your calls now on this topic. We've got Jim to start us off in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I heard your speaker's comments about the decline of crime, and she's accurate in the sense that the highest rate of crime, according to Justice Department FBI statistics, was in the 1970s, because you had a highest percentage of people between the ages of 15 and 29, young people, the ones that commit crimes. But I think she was misleading in the sense that violent crimes, including crimes against children, are much higher in the 2000s than they were in the 1960s. So in that regard, I don't think she should equate 1963 America with 2015 America, because there are categories of offenses that are much more dangerous and are higher now than in the 63, although there has been a continuing decline in crime from Justice Department statistics as our population of younger people get fewer and our population ages. So I just think that's something that your viewers or listeners should consider. I'll take my response off the air.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Catherine in Racine now. Catherine, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
What do you think, Catherine?
My mother was raised in 1970s, 1980s, Wisconsin. She was born and raised here in Racine. She got to be a part of that generation, the last generation, in my opinion, that got to go out from sun up to sundown and their parents not have to worry about coming to their doors with the police saying, how dare you leave your child out? How dare you neglect them? I wish I could do that with my child. I mean, my mom used to do that with me, but it was within a fenced yard. I was in that one yard. I wasn't allowed to go out on the block because my mom was afraid after one incident with the police that she was going to be arrested for child neglect. And it's ridiculous. I should be able to allow my son to go out and play at the park. I should be able to allow my son to cross the street if I deem it safe. I like the lady that you had interviewed. I'm sorry, I forgot her name. but like she said, I'm a rational parent. I should be able to make that decision for my child.
Catherine, thanks a lot for the call. We are taking your calls on what we just talked to Lenore Scanese about, a case where parents were charged with unsubstantiated child neglect for letting their kids walk about a mile home from a park in Maryland. Asking what you think. Do you think we're too cautious? We keep the kids too cooped up, don't let them go out and do their own thing without constant supervision. 800-642-1234 is the number. We've got Scott and Elmina with us now. Scott, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Yeah, I grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota. Used to walk a mile out of school uphill both ways, of course. my kids are 10, 9, and 8. They've walked to school. We live right in Elmina. It's about a 7-block walk. They've walked there to school since kindergarten by themselves. I followed them for the first couple of weeks, made sure they got there and knew the route. They haven't had a problem, ever. So I don't see what the big deal is about letting kids, you know, if they're old enough to walk to school by themselves, which the school says they are, then they're old enough to walk a mile to a park.
All right, Scott. Thanks for the call. We've got Matthew in Ashland now. Matthew, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I was calling. I'm in the process of studying natural resources as an undergrad at Northern College in Ashland. And I've been really interested to study some of the early relationships that children develop with natural resources. And, you know, I grew up taken an annual hunting trip to northern Wisconsin, and I've seen that, you know, in my childhood, my time spent alone in the woods has it's been very influential in developing who I am today. And I think that's an important aspect we need to look at, as to how much time children are allowed to spend out in the woods and the values that they develop.
All right, Matthew, thanks so much. Thanks to all of you for sharing your thoughts. You can continue the conversation over at the Central Time Facebook page. Now, after dropping below $2 a gallon in Wisconsin and across the country for the first time in 6 years, gas prices are back on the rise.
Both the Wisconsin average and the national average are just slightly above $2 a gallon, with prices expected to continue to rise. This comes at a time, though, when crude oil prices have remained low.
Here to give us the scoop on what to expect at the pump and why is Jim Ritterbusch, president of the Chicago oil trading advisory firm Ritterbusch & Associates. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Rob. Appreciate your inviting.
So we keep seeing stories of crude oil prices down. So why are we seeing gas prices starting to inch back up?
Well, actually, crude prices have also lifted here during the past 5 or 6 weeks. And it just so happened that gasoline prices advanced about twice as much as the crude price did for several reasons.
So what are some of those reasons? Why was gas outpacing crude oil?
Well, we've seen a significant lift in demand due to the low prices. We've seen some nationwide strikes at some of the refineries that have disrupted output to some degree. We had a major refinery explosion out on the West Coast, and generally, when we have strong prices in Europe and the Brent, so-called Brent benchmark, that tends to lift gasoline prices in the U.S.
Is there a seasonal angle on this too?
There is a seasonal angle. There's a pretty reliable seasonal, as a matter of fact, within the spring period ahead of the grade switchovers. We switch from the winter grade to the summer grade each May, and as a result of that shift, production costs ramp up, and people anticipate the heavier driving season, and there's a lot of speculative interest in the long side of the gasoline at this time of the year.
So do we expect gas prices to keep on going up? What's the projection for the next few months?
My projection is that we'll see these relatively higher levels sustained for a couple of months, maybe into about June, maybe early July. But I do think that by early summer, we're going to begin drafting back down again. And while I think that we've seen the lows placed for the year, I think there's a good possibility that we could see a return back to around the $2 mark.
But you're not seeing a risk of, you know, that $3 to $4 range we were at for a while there?
I don't see that that risk on the table, at least as far as this year is concerned. Looking out to next year, there's always a certain geopolitical risk given an array of cross currents, of geopolitical cross currents around the globe. But by and large, we've got ample gasoline supply. Roughly 10 million barrels above normal. We've got crude stocks in the United States at the highest level they've been since about 1930. So we've got enough crude, and we've got the refinery capacity to process into gasoline. So it looks to me like this year we generally stay south of about $2.80 or so in Wisconsin anyway.
I want to get into what's fueling, if you'll forgive the word, that large amount of crude oil. Is this a lot coming from domestic production here in the U.S., in part from fracking?
Yes, that's a significant driver of that increase. We've got production in the U.S. at 30-year highs, around 9.3 million barrels a day. So if you just go back maybe 7 years or so, we've boosted that output by about 40 or 50%, and it's ongoing and hasn't run its course yet. I would say we're probably looking a couple of months down the road before we start to see reduced output production begin to level off in response to the low prices.
Are we in the United States driving down global crude oil prices because of this increased production?
Well, it's always a combination. It's not only the increased supply within the United States, but OPEC backing up to last fall had a meeting and they opted to maintain their relatively lofty production quotas of about 30 million barrels per day. So they didn't respond to the price weakening, and as a matter of fact, the Saudis appear intent in producing at highest levels in a couple of years. So that that downside pressure is emanating from the Mideast as well as the U.S.
Did I see a reference somewhere, I thought, to maybe we're running low on storage space for crude oil waiting to be refined? Is that going to be an issue?
At some point, it could be. That's a bit stretched, though. Roughly, in the United States, we're running at about 65-70% as far as storage capacity is concerned. So we've got a ways to go, notwithstanding the fact that we're at a near-record supply. We still have a ways to go before that storage is filled. But in the meantime, we have a very stubborn crude market that doesn't want to stay much below the $50 mark. And what I see is all of this unused storage space providing a incremental source of demand. So we just keep pushing it into storage, and at some point we'll hit a storage wall, what I call it, and at that point then we could see some serious price weakening, not only in crude prices, but also at the pump and the gasoline.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too. That's Jim Ritterbusch, president of the oil trading advisory firm Ritterbusch & Associates, talking about gas prices and predictions for the coming year.
In case you missed it, today is National Grammar Day, and we want to hear from you. Do you have a grammar question, or maybe you have a grammatical pet peeve? Are there certain grammar rules you always get hung up on? You can call in and share at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And given that we both talk on the radio for a living, me and Veronica is always game for some grammar tips. Here to help teach us how to talk real good is Mignon Fogarty, also known as Grammar Girl. She's a podcaster and author of several best-selling grammar books. Mignon, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. That made me cringe just a little bit.
Mission accomplished. Well, tell us a little bit about National Grammar Day. Why are we taking this national day to attend to our grammar?
Well, National Grammar Day was founded by an author named Martha Brockenbrow quite a few years ago now, and it just has caught on because it's so much fun to celebrate grammar online. If you go on Twitter right now and follow the Grammar Day hashtag, you see people baking cookies with punctuation marks on them, celebrating in writing centers at universities. There's a hashtag game called Grammar Movies going on where people are changing the title of movies to have a grammar theme. It's just a blast.
You would think the grammar would be something wonky, but people get really hopped up, passionate, and excited about grammar. How come?
I think we all have to write. You know, it's something we interact with or do ourselves every day, and so everybody feels as if they have a little bit of investment, you know, in the language.
So sometimes when we're talking about people breaking grammar rules, there's a sense that we're getting worse. We're endemifying, if you will. You've made the case that it's not necessarily bad when language changes. It actually can be a natural and decent evolution. Talk about that a little.
Right. Well, if you go back in history and look at the things people objected to in the past, they sound somewhat ridiculous. So in, you know, the 1700s, there was a very prominent grammarian who said we shouldn't use the word who to refer to children because or babies, because who should be reserved for rational beings. So which is just ridiculous today. And, you know, but that's how they thought back then. And so when you look through the long history of words, another one, drapes. drapes is an Americanism, drapes for the word curtains, and you know, it was, that word was objected to when it first came into use, and the British sniffed at it as an Americanism and an error. So, you know, there's a long history of objection to things that become normal in standard English over time. So it's, when you realize that, it's a lot harder to get worked up about things today.
Seems like some people delight in being sticklers, and other people are sort of more essentialist about it, and their argument is something, you know, like if people have a message and it's clear and it's understood, who cares if the grammar is perfect or not? What do you say to that?
Right. Well, you know, it's part of that language changing. So, you know, you think about Apple's campaign, Think Different. You know, we all know what they meant, and it was actually a very effective marketing message. And there are things in English called flat adverbs. So actually, drive slow, you'll see a lot of people object to that. But if you, you know, if you go to the dictionary, if you listen to usage experts, that's drive slow is actually fine. Slow is what's called a flat adverb. So, you know, Think Different could have been using that flat adverb idea to make their message. But, you know, also Apple has a history of pushing the boundaries of English. They, I think Steve Jobs talked about the iPod being the funnest iPod ever or something like that a few years ago, the iPod or the iPhone. You know, so they love to be controversial, too, with their language and get attention by using things that are really pushing the boundaries.
So, Mignon, you sound like you're open to some changes in the way we talk, but in my intentional bad grammar in the lead-up, you said you cringed a bit. So where's the line? Where do we need to make sure or try our best, anyway, to get the grammar right?
I know, it's a tough call, and even though I think language change is fun, I still encourage people to follow, you know, the style guides when they're writing professionally or for school. So if you're writing for a newspaper, you have to follow AP style. And if you're writing a novel, you should follow Chicago style. Like, those are the standards of the industry and what are considered the rules of standard English today. You know, just a few days ago, a friend asked me the same question. He said, well, you know, you like language change, but my friend says that it's fine to write a lot as one word instead of two, and what do you think of that? I'm like, no, that's still an error. So, I think it's one of those you know it when you see it kind of things, and there are standards that are still upheld by the style guides and major publications.
So how do you feel about new words entering the lexicon? Words like, I don't know, twerk and selfie.
Well, they're awfully useful, aren't they? I mean, how else are we going to describe twerking or a selfie? You know, so new things need new names. You know, there are some areas that are, those to me seem like examples where we clearly need a word to describe what they are. A word that has been fascinating me lately is adulting. So you hear people in their 20s say things like, oh, adulting is hard. And what they mean is being an adult is hard. You know, my family friend said that, and I was like, well, what did you have to do? And she said, well, I had to go to the bank and open a bank account, and then I had to go to the DMV, and it was just a nightmare. And I knew what she meant. And this word seems to be taking off in pockets of 20-year-olds around the country. If you track it on Twitter, it gets tweeted about 100 times a day. You can find a tweet with the word adulting. And, you know, that annoys some people. You know, they don't like turning nouns into verbs and think
verbing.
We don't need a word. We can say being an adult or being a grown-up. But so it's adulting is more like slang than a new word, and it'll just be a matter of time before we find out whether it catches on and makes its way into the lexicon, into standard English, or if it just stays as that slang of people in their 20s for a few years.
We're talking to grammar girl Mignon Fogarty about National Grammar Day. We'll go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. We've got Tim on the line in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hi. I always had a personal war against the apostrophe. I always felt like the word can't doesn't necessarily need an apostrophe to get the point of the word across. Until one of my friends pointed out the combination of who and are. If you drop the A, it becomes a and put an apostrophe, you are. If you don't put the apostrophe, it's a completely different word.
That's so funny. And a rare instance where you use an apostrophe to make things plural is when you're using single letters. So you would write, I got 4 A's on my report card last year, and you would do A apostrophe S. And at least in part, that's because we need to distinguish it from words. So it would look like as instead of A's. So it always intrigued me that it's an exception where we really need the apostrophe to make things plural.
A war against the apostrophe sounds like a lonely war to me, probably one that's lost, but that's interesting. Thanks, Tim, for that. And we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line. Judy in Marinette says she thinks part of the problem is that students today aren't taught to diagram sentences, and she thinks if kids did have to diagram sentences, they'd have a better sense of proper structure. What do you think about old-fashioned sentence diagramming?
I love diagramming sentences. I was lucky enough to do it for about a week in grade school, and I really loved it. And then a few years ago, I decided to make a Grammar Girl Christmas card with a diagrammed greeting inside. So I went and bought a bunch of old workbooks and retaught myself how to diagram sentences. And I spent about 3 days on it because I knew I had to get it right if we were going to print all those Christmas cards. And, you know, it really did help me think about sentence structure and modifying phrases and things like that that I had. I don't know. I think maybe if you're a visual learner, it can help you sort of see a sentence in a different way from how you saw it before when you're just trying to think about adverbs and adjectives and prepositional phrases. When you can put them on an image like that, it gives you a different perspective. So I think for some students, at least, it would probably be very helpful.
We're talking right now with the grammar girl, Mignon Fogarty, about common grammar mistakes and your pet peeves.
And we're taking your calls, too. Do you have a question for the grammar girl? Do you have a grammatical pet peeve? Or maybe you'd like to offer up your own helpful grammar tip? Call in and share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're brushing up on our grammar with Grammar Girl Mignon Fogarty.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite grammar tip or maybe something that just really bugs you when you hear other people saying it? It's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got Dick on the line in Madison. Hi, Dick.
Hi. Am I on?
Yep, you are.
Okay, I've got a pet peeve about grammar. You keep hearing people, including news anchors, the president, and everybody else, misusing reflexive pronouns. Instead of just a regular pronoun, they say things like, my mother gave a dollar to my brother and myself.
Hmm.
Well, it's not giving to yourself. It should be saying to my brother and me.
Ah, good point.
And everybody does it.
Right. Well, thanks for bringing that up. I haven't thought about reflexive pronouns in a long time. Can you give us a quick 101, Mignon?
You bet. Well, I remember the name by thinking of seeing your reflection in a mirror. So you would say, I see myself, and that's the proper use of a reflexive pronoun. So the myself refers to something that came earlier in the sentence. You're reflecting back. That's a little bit redundant, but you're reflecting back to the mention of yourself earlier in the sentence. So you need that first I before you can use a reflexive to go back to myself. So I see myself in the mirror, and himself, herself, ourselves, those are all reflexive pronouns. They can also be used for emphasis. So you can say, I baked the cake myself. You know, that means the same thing as I baked the cake. It means the identical thing, but if you add the myself, you're adding emphasis. So those are the two common ways that you would use myself. Now, the caller's correct that you often hear people say things, especially in business and speeches when they're trying to sound smart or important. People will say, you know, send the memo to Bob and myself. Well, really, it should be Bob and me. You want the object pronoun me in that case. So the caller's right.
I'm sure I've made that mistake myself. But I just used it right that time, right?
Yes. Aha. Yes, that's correct.
All right, thanks.
Yep.
Dick, thanks for the call. We'll go to Eric now in Madison. Eric, hi.
Hi. So I have a question on the use of, with the contraction of they have and adding got on the end. So they've got, I've got, we've got, what's the proper way to do that? I mean, or is that even proper, or is that just a local use?
Oh, so it sounds redundant. They have got a something. Mignon, what do you think?
I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. I know that you can use got for emphasis. So you can say, you know, you have got to see this fish at the aquarium. And I know that that use is considered okay for got. Off the top of my head, I can't remember about the other uses. But it's sometimes, at least, it's okay for emphasis.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Eric.
And we'll go next to Sandy in Libertyville, Illinois. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Sandy. Hi, Sandy. No, that's me.
Hi, myself.
It gets confusing.
I have a bit of a literal pet peeve. I'm very active in the animal welfare and rescue world. We will often see ads for animals that are up for adoption that describe the animal. Loves this, loves to do this, and loves to be pet. Hmm. Now, what I think they're saying is the animal loves to be petted. But it has become universal to say Buffy loves to be pet. Oh. And what amazes me is that it's caught on and that everybody's using it, and it's making me question, well, is petted not a real word?
Right. Okay, thanks, Sandy. So, Mignon, is there an epidemic of confusing pet with petted?
There is. We did a Grammar Girl podcast about it a few years ago, and I'm trying to remember which one is right. I know it comes up with grit and gritted, too. You could say he grit his teeth or he gritted his teeth. It looks as if these verbs, some of them are evolving to become shorter like that. So, gosh, I would say check the Grammar Girl website. I search my own website actually quite often because I can't remember everything we've covered either. We've done more than 450 different episodes, so there's a lot to remember when it comes to English.
My money's on petted.
Me
I'd
too.
Love to know which
I'm
one
going
it
petted.
Is. Maybe we'll look for it and come back tomorrow and tell you.
Could be in flux, okay. Though. Could be one in flux.
True.
Sandy, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Paula with us in Oshkosh. Paula, hi.
Hi, good to hear this program. Thank you. It makes my ears bleed when I hear it, my eyes bleed when I see it, when people do orientated or orientating. I'm pretty sure it's still oriented or orienting. So it's become my mission to educate everybody that comes in front of me.
Yeah, that sounds like one, Mignon, thanks for that, Paula, we're one where, well, this sounds fancier and more educated, so it's probably right, when in fact we don't need that extra syllable at all.
Right. Yes. And, you know, the two words mean the same thing, orient and orientate. They both exist. You'll find them both in the dictionary. But an orient is the older verb, but orientate has been around for quite a long time, too.
So it's not necessarily wrong, it sounds like.
No, it's not. But
sorry,
orient
Paula.
Is the preferred form in American English.
Ah.
So this is an American English versus British English difference. So we'll say, you know, orient the chairs toward the sun. In Britain, they would say orient or orientate. They sort of coexist as equally acceptable alternatives. But it looks like the American preference is orient.
Thanks, Paula. Don't move to the UK.
All right. Do we have time for one more quick call? Karen in Portage, you're on.
Yeah. So one that I notice a lot of people do nowadays is they would say, like, it's almost like they're answering a question for somebody. Like if they were saying, do you want to go to the movie or not? Instead of saying or not, they say, do you want to go to the movie or no?
Okay, well, that's something that you hear here in Wisconsin. I think
I've done it.
Oh, I see. I thought you were gesturing to me because I do that
too.
What about that one? Is that one charming, Mignon?
I'm guessing that that's probably a regionalism that is specific to your area because I haven't heard it before. And there are things that you know, people say in different regions. Is needs washed one of the things they say in Wisconsin? The car needs washed.
No, that's not a local thing here. No.
No, okay, that must be somewhere else. That might be Pittsburgh. But there are these regionalisms, and or no, you know, I've never heard it. So my guess would be that it's something specific to your area.
Mignot, thank you so much for joining us and talking grammar.
You're welcome, and thank you, and happy National Grammar Day.
Happy National Grammar Day back at you. We've been speaking with Mignot Fogarty, best-selling author and host of the podcast Grammar Girl.
A patchwork of local ordinances restricting where sex offenders can live has made it hard to find housing for them once they're released. But as Gilman Halstead reports, there's a move afoot to establish a statewide standard that will prevent offenders from being concentrated in towns and cities without those restrictions.
On a snowy night in January, about 50 residents of the Dane County town of Windsor gathered in the town hall to learn more about Stephen Lamb. He's a sex offender scheduled to move into their small suburban community. Tina Gensler of the Department of Corrections laid out Lamb's criminal history, which began in 1990.
Mr. Lamb was 17 years old, and he had sexual touching of an 11-year-old non-related female acquaintance. He was at a park where she was playing, and just to preface, I know we have a couple younger children in the here today. I just want you to know that some of this could be graphic.
Lamb is 43 years old now and has spent most of the last 20 years in prison for sexual assaults on children. But DOC officials at the meeting assured his future neighbors that he's got a full-time job now and is wearing a GPS tracking bracelet 24 hours a day so law enforcement can keep a close eye on him. There are about 700 sex offenders with GPS bracelets in the state right now, but that doesn't reassure Windsor resident Carolyn Stegman.
I know that the probability of a repeat offense is fairly high for child sex offenders, and I don't want my child to be the guinea pig for the next offense.
A Department of Corrections study covering the period between 1980 and 2002 found that between 9% and 15% of child sex offenders in Wisconsin committed new crimes after they were released. Another resident at the meeting, Tony Steffen, says he's unhappy with zoning restrictions in nearby communities that have left few options for towns like Windsor.
There are cities who put laws in place that they don't want any of these sex offenders, so then that forces neighboring cities, much like DeForest and Windsor here, where Sun Prairie's put a law into effect that they don't want any of these type of violators, and then it's going to force neighboring cities to maybe have to harbor these people.
That's something Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett is hoping to change. He wants lawmakers to impose statewide standards.
And I don't think there's a mayor in the state who would want to be in the situation where you're saying, oh, well, just bring me all of your sex offenders. That just isn't going to happen.
Barrett's teamed up with Republican State Representative Joel Clayfish to draft the new law. Clayfish says it will supersede all local ordinances.
And we're going to have a return to sender component to it, where the sex offender lives when he commits the offense. It's the community where they have to be returned. That is the most equitable situation.
Such a law could face opposition from residents of towns like Cottage Grove. Last month, someone set fire to a house there where state officials had planned to place a sex offender. Murali Kudipudi lives next door. He's leading the effort to get the town board to pass an ordinance barring violent sex offenders from the community.
How can I believe that this guy is monitored 24 hours? Oh, you don't need to worry. We'll take care of it, this GPS, that, and all this technical mumbo-jumbo. I mean, if he can put the trash can outside, he can come to my yard.
This week, the town board agreed to draft an ordinance before the end of the month. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.